This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Cities are projected to get 4 degrees C hotter during this century, a scorching 7 degrees Fahrenheit. That is just the average. Heat waves will go beyond human endurance. I talk with scientist Li Zhao. But world governments have a plan they claim is green. We will capture carbon out of the atmosphere and get more energy as a bonus. Dr. Robert Nichols, the director of the UK Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research, finds the bioenergy scheme competes with water needed by billions of humans, not to mention all other creatures. But first, Johannes Lohmann from the University of Copenhagen warns Earth will hit climate tipping points much sooner than expected due to the rate of climate change. Buckle up for hair-raising triple science right here on Radio EcoShock.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
From the University of Copenhagen, we reach the lead author of worrying new research about the speed of climate change. Dr. Johannes Lohmann is a postdoc at Denmark's famous Niels Bohr Institute. His 5 papers as a young scientist are about hunting for abrupt climate events during the last glacial period. Now he has news about grave risks in the future. Johannes Lohmann, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Your paper, it's absolutely shocking, and I'm not easily shocked these days. But let's get there step by step. We'll take our time. You have intensively studied something called Danskar-Oeschger events. What are they?
These Danskar-Oeschger events are abrupt climate changes in the last glacial period. And the last glacial period spanned from about 120,000 years ago to 12,000 years ago when the Holocene began. And these events are basically the best evidence we have that abrupt climate change can happen even on a large scale. And during these events, which are best recorded in Greenland ice cores, temperature over Greenland rose by up to 15 degrees Celsius in a matter of a couple of decades. And this had repercussions around the globe. So these were events where the pace of climate change was even faster than what we're experiencing now. And unfortunately, the cause of these events is not really, well, it's still debated. There's a lot of progress being made in recent times, but there's still no consensus of what the mechanism behind these is. And so, of course, if we want to predict climate change in the future, we have to try to build models that can also explain climate change in the past.
Has a rapid warming like that happened in, say, the last 100,000 years?
Yes. So these Danskar-Oeschger events, they have been happening within the last 100,000 years. So they stopped about 20,000 years ago, even though the last deglaciation, so the period where we transitioned from the last glacial period into the current warm period, was also very abrupt.
I want to go back to what you just said a minute ago. We don't know why these events happen. I mean, Earth seems to coast along in one climate for thousands or even millions of years and then shifts. And are these shifts always towards a warming, or can they also be toward a cooling?
So these shifts, they come in cycles. So they actually comprise both a warming and a cooling, even though the warming is a little bit more abrupt. And in terms of the cause of these, so we don't know of any external forcing that can explain why these climate changes have been happening with the periodicity that they have been happening and also with the abruptness. So they are in some way an internal mechanism in the climate system. And even though we know quite a bit about what parts of the climate system played a role in these changes, we don't really know the precise trigger of these events.
Well, let's say the ice cores show that Greenland ice increased by around 8 degrees C over 40 years within a single human lifetime. Does that prove the whole world warmed that far, that fast?
It doesn't. Because typically, also what we're seeing now with anthropogenic climate change is that there's a polar amplification. So if you have a warming, the higher latitudes tend to warm quite a bit faster than the lower latitudes. So a warming of that much in Greenland would not be a warming of 8 degrees around the globe. But there are other recorded archives from, for example, ocean sediment cores and lake sediment cores that also show these signals in completely different parts of the world, even though with slightly smaller amplitude.
When we're talking about these things, Johannes, do you prefer the term critical threshold or tipping point?
Good question. I'm fine with both. I mean, critical threshold would sort of assume that there is such a thing as a critical threshold in the system that needs to be crossed in order for this to happen. A tipping point would be maybe a slightly more general term that describes this phenomenon. And we're not really sure which of these apply, actually. So both terms are good from my side.
Was it your previous research or something else that brought you to ask this key question, is Earth's climate basically unstable?
Certainly. So I entered this field from complex system science, and there you hear a lot about nonlinear dynamics and abrupt shifts that can suddenly happen with only a very slight or very slow and slight triggers. And then when I started to study paleoclimate and seeing all of these abrupt changes happening in the past and seeing that a current generation of climate models has a really hard time in reproducing these changes, it seems very urgent to try to see whether we can capture any of these processes happening in the future.
Your new paper is published in the top journal, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. The title is Risk of Tipping the Overturning Circulation Due to Increasing Rates of Ice Melt. Let's unpack that a little bit. Is ice melt increasing at both poles?
It is certainly increasing in Greenland. In Antarctica, it depends a little bit on which part of the ice sheet you're looking at. But for the overturning circulation, what is important is the Greenland melt. And there's strong evidence that this has been increasing from satellite data, so basically direct evidence of this happening.
Please describe for the non-scientist what you mean by the overturning circulation.
So the overturning circulation, here I'm in the paper I'm talking specifically about the Atlantic overturning circulation, and that is a system of currents which is part of a global ocean circulation that transports heat and water masses around the globe. And what happens in the Atlantic is that this flow is sort of like a loop where warm water is transported from the low latitudes to the high latitudes northwards at the surface. And then this water, fairly warm and salty water, is being cooled by the atmosphere, and in the high latitudes it starts to sink and then return back southwards where it then upwells and closes this loop. So you have a circulation that basically distributes heat from south to north, and by doing so it really shapes the climate specifically of the northern hemisphere but also of the southern hemisphere.
Yes, it's pretty important for the UK, for Europe, and even probably for Denmark, I guess, that if you had the winters of the latitude where you're really located, you'd be much colder except for this warming current.
That's precisely true. I mean, you can, for example, compare Canada, where you're located, to Scandinavia, and you can see if you look at equal latitudes, you can see quite big differences in temperature. That's true.
Have scientists previously attempted to quantify when this Atlantic meridional overturning circulation, to use the formal term, when it could shift, even in what century we might expect that big change?
Certainly. So that's, our study is far from being the first of asking that question. This has been a concern for quite a long time, both in the context of paleoclimate, but also in the future. But it requires fairly long simulations with climate models. So there has been a long quest for this happening, but so far, also the most realistic ensemble of climate models disagree quite a lot on where actually this tipping point is sitting, and even if there is such a tipping point, so there's still no consensus in between models.
Well, suppose current climate models could assure us that ice melts slowly enough, the Atlantic current could not be diverted for at least the next few hundred years or more. Why are you warning we cannot rest safely on that kind of prediction?
Well, there are two things. So first of all, what our study is showing is that rate also matters. So most studies so far have been looking at a tipping point in the more classical sense, which means that there should be some kind of concrete value of a climate forcing, which in this case, well, could either be the CO2 levels or more directly the melt coming off of Greenland. And if you slowly approach this tipping point, then you will tip at exactly that value. But what our study is showing that you could have this other effect, which is called rate-induced tipping, where a tipping can actually occur even before this threshold, given that you approach the threshold at a faster rate. So this is something that could go on top of this tipping point that has already been discovered before. And this could mean that the ocean circulation would tip earlier. But another aspect that we're also seeing in our study is that if you look at tipping points in fairly complex systems, which feature chaotic dynamics, it can happen that you're actually not really able to predict at what point the system is going to tip, because there's a very sensitive dependence on the initial state of the ocean when you're starting to make this change to the climate system, and also on the exact progression of this climate forcing, so the exact value of the rate of change that you're using. And this could make it fundamentally impossible to actually predict where exactly this tipping point will lie.
I'm trying to picture this, and I'm thinking in my mind of perhaps an older man with a heart condition who's going to run for a mile. And he can do it if he just takes it steady and runs that mile. But if he suddenly races up too quickly in the middle of the race, he might fall over because his heart has overacted. Is that the kind of situation you're describing when you talk about the rate importance, the rate tipping point?
Yeah, I think that's a very good analogy, actually. This is precisely what we're looking at.
Well, a few years ago, I interviewed a young Texas scientist who used abandoned coral reefs to show sea level rise jumped up several feet suddenly, much too quickly for a coral to adapt. It was not the steady ramp up we show in our charts. Do you think that we are being dangerously deceptive in our assumptions about gradualism?
I think so. I mean, these kind of effects where rate can matter also qualitatively, not only quantitatively, have not really been stressed enough. I mean, everybody is, of course, aware that the rate of change of climate change matters in terms of our ability to adapt towards the changing climate. But also here we show that it can matter, actually, the qualitative outcome of this climate change experiment, if you want to call it like that, can depend on the rate of change that you're using to get there. So there should be more emphasis given on this.
Do your findings mean problems for the way we have been using climate models?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, I think the way that climate models have been used is often out of necessity. I mean, for example, the study that we've been able to do is using a fairly low resolution climate model to be able to make these large ensembles of simulations that allow you to systematically study this effect. But previous studies, they were looking at it from either end. So either a gradual change in conditions to uncover whether there actually is such a tipping point and where precisely it lies, and that's important on its own, or making a very fast change to the climate system, so more like a shock, and see whether there actually is another state out there that we could reach if we tip very fast. What we're trying to do is we're filling this gap in between these two scenarios. So I don't think there has been anything wrong with the way that climate models have been used so far.
Johannes Lohmann, what sort of feedback about this paper are you getting from other scientists?
I'm getting fairly positive feedback. Of course, it's worrying news, but at least in the more mathematically inclined community, people have been waiting for this effect to be uncovered also in a climate model. So people are excited about it, even though it's, of course, pretty bad news.
As you state in the new paper, this insight into instability may or may not apply to super complex natural systems at the global level. Is there any way to take your research to the next step to find out?
Certainly. Two avenues would be good. I mean, one is the obvious avenue is just to try to look at this phenomenon in even more complex models, so very coupled climate or Earth system models that incorporate more processes than we had. This, of course, just takes a lot of computational effort, but at some point that should definitely be done. And the other aspect would be to try to understand the physics of these tipping points better, to understand what are actually the physics that determine whether such this rate-induced effect is present or not. And I think if these two lines are pursued in parallel, we might know more about whether this effect will apply in the real climate system.
Well, given what we know so far, Johannes, should we accept that civilization could be jeopardized by a rapid jump in temperatures, that it's possible?
I certainly think so, unfortunately. Even though our study is not precise enough to give you the quantitative evidence for this, but just pointing out that this effect can exist, given that you have a tipping point, I think would be enough to take this risk seriously.
Well, in my view, your science is another reason to declare a global climate emergency, to apply every brake we can on human greenhouse gas emissions. And if we allow the possibility of multiple instabilities in natural systems, well, we have to take the science at some point, and we have to take it to government leaders and to people who are consuming fossil fuels and say, okay, we may have to change our urgency and message. Do you feel that's the case with the science that you're bringing up?
I think it is the case. Again, of course, it's difficult to convince people without any strong quantitative evidence. But I think if this research that we have been doing is being confirmed by other models, it might be a good idea to also bring this rate of change into play here. Because currently, I mean, if you look, for example, at the Paris Agreement and so on, I mean, all of the climate targets have been targeting certain levels of climate change, either in terms of warming or total CO2 output into the atmosphere. But it might be at some point worthwhile to also include a cap on the rate of change as kind of another dimension of this safe operating space that we're trying to stay in.
Yes, again, I'm trying to picture where we really are with what we know and what we don't know about climate change. And I remember multiple news stories about tourists who visit the Grand Canyon and they want to get selfies of themselves near the edge. So they keep backing up to get a better shot. And then, sadly, some of them fall in. And I wonder if that isn't where we are right now, that we're backing up rather blindly into a climate situation that we're just discovering how it works.
I think certainly that's unfortunately the case. So even though if you take as an example this tipping point that we're looking at, which is the overturning circulation, so far, luckily, the models say that we are still quite far way ahead of this tipping point in terms of the amount of meltwater that you would need it to shut down the circulation. But on the other hand, these same models don't really agree well with observation. So you can now, for I think 15 years now, you can actually observe the strength of this circulation, and you could see a slight, or not even a slight, you can definitely see a decrease in the circulation, which is not really captured by the models. You can also see a much higher variability of the circulation that is not captured by models. So it might be that this tipping point is earlier than these models are telling us. So in a way, we are approaching this tipping point rather blindly.
Are you and your colleagues at Niels Bohr Institute able to continue your science despite the pandemic?
It depends a little bit on who you ask. Unfortunately, a large part of our group has been dealing with ice cores, and we've been very much impeded by the pandemic. I'm luckily mostly working with theory, so running computer models and so on, and this could be done fine from home. But all of the field work that is typically put into collecting ice cores in Greenland has been halted now already for the second year in a row. So unfortunately, it has been quite a big blow to the science in our group.
Yes, I talked to an Antarctic specialist whose expedition was canceled because of COVID. And in fact, he said it might even be delayed 2 years because they need an extra year to get all the supplies they need down there by ship, and the ship only goes once a year. So science is, well, on edge with the pandemic, as is everything else.
Yeah, that's unfortunately exactly what also happened to our group. So I was also supposed to go to Greenland both this year and last year to help with drilling of the ice core, but both of these seasons had to be canceled. But of course, nobody to blame for that. I mean, these are pretty vulnerable parts in the earth, so they are really trying to keep the virus out as much as possible.
I see a pattern and direction in your published papers so far. Where is it taking you, Johannes?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure what I want to do next. I've been now also interested in extreme events in a more general perspective, which also had been fueled quite a bit by the pandemic that we're experiencing, because it's just another very, very large extreme event that nobody really saw coming. What I've been trying to work on in the past, also with this paper, is a little bit to think about what kind of extreme events can we predict, how can we predict them, and how can we implement these findings that we see from, for example, idealized model studies? So I think this is kind of a direction in general where I want to be heading.
We have been speaking with Dr. Johannes Lohmann from the Niels Bohr Institute in Denmark. Find links to his new paper and much more in my blog at ecoshock.org. Johannes, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We return to the expert who advises governments, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and multiple projects around the world. Robert J. Nichols is the director of the UK's Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research and chair of climate adaptation at the University of East Anglia. Dr. Robert Nichols, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I was looking at Columbia University's Earth Institute report, and they said by 2025, about 35% of humans will live within 60 miles of the coast. But why should the rest of the people, those living inland, stay tuned to our discussion about rising seas?
Well, I think the effects of sea level are kind of felt everywhere indirectly. I mean, I think most people living inland often go to the coast for their holidays on a sort of simple basis. But also, if there's problems at the coast, I mean, we have huge amounts of population located there, then that will have effects on the economy inland. So it's really, even though it's happening in a specific geographic place, the consequences have global ramifications.
Yes, I'm reminded of flooding that happened in Thailand in 2011. That sounds far away, but it turns out most of the factories making the world's hard drives had to shut down. Western Digital lost 60% of their production. So we're all so tied together, and especially to those areas in Asia which are prone to flooding. Why Asia?
Asia is very flood-prone in the coastal regions because we have very large numbers of extensive and populated deltas. So sort of more than 70% of the world's coastal population is located in South, Southeast, and East Asia. So it's really the hotspot for human exposure to sort of sea level rise and coastal hazards in general. And those areas, the economies are growing very fast. So they've become, over the last 30 years, real key hubs in the world economy as well.
And then there's the food problem. I interviewed veteran diplomat David Brown about salty water going over and under the Mekong Delta, one of the world's biggest rice exporters. And what happens when these fertile deltas in Vietnam or Bangladesh go salty and then go under because of climate change?
Well, the salt water has been penetrating into these deltas because of sea level rise, and that really has a big effect on the productivity of rice and all agricultural crops. So that is something of concern. I think it's also interesting that they're finding actually in the Mekong that salt water is penetrating into the delta not because of sea level rise, but actually because they're dredging so much sand out of the Mekong that the river's getting deeper, and that actually affects the tidal wave, so the salt is going further inland. So in these areas, it's partly sea level rise, but there are other things going on too, but they're having the same net effect, I mean, of impacts.
Well, that's a big thing in your new paper, that humans are changing the planet, sometimes inadvertently, a bit at a time, and it's a lot more than climate change that changes how far the sea comes up on us. What is one of the other major factors that we're finding when it comes to the world's cities?
Well, it's subsidence, really. What we've been doing is looking at when you think about sea level rise, there's the climate induced aspect, which is which is sort of the melting of ice and land based ice and the thermal expansion of seawater, which means that the level of the ocean rises. But if you're living on the coast, if the sea rises, you don't actually know, is the sea rising or is the land sinking? And if you're at a local place, you've really got to take into account both effects. And what we find is in some of the big cities in Asia, and actually many of these deltas that I mentioned earlier in my in the discussion, are actually sinking quite significantly. And this is adding, so the climate effect is being reinforced by this sinking effect.
Yes, the capital of Indonesia, Jakarta, they're talking about having to move it to a completely different place because it's just going down so fast. There's another shocking case around Tokyo. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Tokyo has subsided about 4.5 meters, not the whole city. And the subsidence is really happening in areas that are deltaic. And there's a delta around the port in the center of Tokyo, and that sank 4.5 meters. So what's that? That's getting on for like 18 feet in the 20th century. And that area now is actually below sea level and is only land thanks to major defenses and pumping. But in the case of Tokyo, they have actually stopped the subsidence because the subsidence is caused by groundwater withdrawal. That's what causes it. And they've stopped the groundwater withdrawal. So they've removed the cause of the subsidence. They've protected the area, but the area now is very, very low-lying and very kind of quite vulnerable, but for the defences that have been put in.
And how would you compare the global impacts of sinking cities with seas rising due to climate change? Is one sort of greater than the other in the millions of people that might be displaced eventually?
At the current time, our analysis shows that the effects of deltas and cities sinking is much bigger than actually climate-induced effects at the current time. So let's be clear on that. So what we're talking about now are observations of what's happening today. We estimated that relative sea level rise experienced by the average piece of coast is about 2.6 millimeters per year. If you are actually a coastal inhabitant and coastal and people live in areas that tend to sink, you're experiencing rates 3 to 4 times higher than that. So maybe 7.5 to 10 in round terms, millimeters per year. So most of that effect is the fact the land is sinking. As we go forward in time, climate-induced sea level rise is becoming bigger, and so the effects of climate change will grow and maybe become dominant in the long run. So to my mind, they're both things you want to worry about, because the net effect is the same.
And you have led papers for the IPCC. What is the current official thinking on how much seas will rise by the year, say, 2050 or 2100?
It depends on how closely we follow the Paris Agreement. So if we really don't do anything about the Paris Agreement and we have sort of what you might call uncontrolled emissions, then certainly a meter rise by 2100 of climate-induced sea level rise is possible, and maybe even more. I mean, it's unlikely above a meter, but and right now the AR6 is actually looking at this, so there'll be new numbers coming out quite soon that will actually give some new numbers. So I'm not actually aware of what those numbers will be. If we follow that something nearer to the Paris Agreement, that will greatly reduce the amount of sea level rise down more to sort of something like, you know, 40 or 50 centimeters. So a substantial reduction. But it's interesting that even if we follow the Paris Agreement, sea levels don't stop rising. We simply slow the rate of rise. And I think one way I think about it is climate mitigation is necessary to make sea level rise manageable, but we'll still need to adapt to the residual rise that really is unstoppable now. Because of the warming we've had, we will see some sea level rise, and we have to live with that, and we have to adapt to that in some way.
Well, the sea level is not stable, but neither is the land level on long time scales. Can you give us a case where sea level rise could be much worse than the global average because the land is sinking for other more natural reasons?
Well, Jakarta, we already mentioned Jakarta. So Jakarta, the land is sinking, in a sort of average rate of about 10 centimeters per year. That's a meter per decade, 10 meters per century, assuming that rate can continue, which it may not be able to continue. And that's due to the pumping of groundwater. So that's only at that one place, but clearly that's producing huge changes that should be avoided. And I would advocate that there needs to be a lot of thought about how do we actually... We talk about mitigating climate change, and we should mitigate climate change. We should also be thinking about mitigating subsidence and policies that try and reduce or even offset this. Because you mentioned moving Jakarta to Borneo. Well, that's an extremely costly measure. And could they actually address the problem in Jakarta rather than move it? I mean, you know, I haven't worked there myself, but I'm just asking that question. And maybe for Jakarta it's too late, but there are many other cities in this case, so I think it's good that these cities get together, compare their experience and learn from each other, and I think hopefully come up with the best strategies for dealing with these problems.
But I was really thinking of another force like New England, for example, that is sinking because formerly the weight of the glaciers that were there only 10 or 12,000 years ago had pushed that land up, but now that the glaciers are gone, the land is slowly sinking. It might make sea level rise in New England worse.
Oh, sure. I mean, that's true. I mean, along the eastern seaboard of the United States, right down to the mid-Atlantic region in you know, Chesapeake Bay and sort of Washington and Philadelphia, that area, the land is sinking for the reason that you just outlined. But the magnitude of that effect is, say, 2 millimeters per year. So it's significant. It makes things worse. It means that in places like Washington, Annapolis, you're seeing maybe 4 millimeters of sea level rise per year under current conditions. But there's not really anything we can actually do about that. We can actually stop pumping groundwater and stop the city sinking. With the situation you're describing to do with the ice sheets, then we have to just live with that and we have to adapt to it. We either have to build defenses or we have to move or whatever the selected response is.
Radio EcoShock will be right back with more from Dr. Robert Nichols, the director of the UK Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You are listening to Professor Robert Nichols on Radio EcoShock. He knows where and why the ocean is threatening land that is home to millions of people. Your new paper is a global analysis of substance, relative sea level change, and coastal flood exposure. That was published March 8, 2021 in the prestigious journal Nature Climate Change. Yes, we can show sinking cities in many countries, but really, Robert, when you add up these local impacts, does it matter on a global scale?
Well, I think the whole point of the paper is yes, because we're saying the average person in the coast is seeing 3 or 4 times the rate of relative sea level rise, so that the substance effects are significant. They are happening in Pacific places, and there are certainly hot spots there, but it's happening quite widely, and many cities are affected, many deltas are affected, and many people are affected. So I think it brings out, it's often considered just a local problem. I would think it's really a global problem. Back to why we care about sea level. Why should people who are not at the coast care about sea level rise, as you posed at the beginning? Well, for the same reason, we should care about these cities that are sinking, and it's probably in everybody's interests to deal with these problems. We have the Sendai Agreement to do with natural hazards, which is trying to mitigate sort of disaster risk, and this is one cause of disaster risk. People like the World Bank and others who fund development in these areas, they're often saying we should be thinking about our exposure to climate change. I would think they should also be thinking about their exposure to substance and relative sea level rise due to substance as well. And so that gives the kind of some examples, I think, of these bigger picture reasons of why we should be concerned. And also, leaving cities to their own devices doesn't help to find the best solutions. If we recognize it as a shared problem, we can start talking about it, we can learn from each other, share experience, and probably come up with better solutions together.
I noticed that Portsmouth, for example, in the UK, has had higher seas but actually lower flooding events because they've come up with portable water gates and other solutions. And I'm reminded, too, of how heat deaths in some cities have gone down, even though there are more heat waves, because they've instituted cooling centers and so on. And my point is that adaptation may actually cover up some of the impacts of climate change for a while, until the problems become too large for what we can afford to do anything about or what we can really do anything about.
I wouldn't say, I found that way you presented it maybe a little bit kind of negative, in the sense I think adaptation's not about a permanent solution. I think adaptation I made the point that sea levels will continue to rise, so it's a long-term challenge. I think that with adaptation measures, we are always making a decision about how to deal with a problem for a 50 or 100-year sort of time frame or whatever. Maybe it's shorter than that. But then we bequeath the problem. I mean, coastal hazards exist today. Coastal hazards have existed in the past. Then it's for future generations to sort of to think about how they might solve the future problems. But I take your point. I mean, it's worthwhile thinking about the long-term consequences of these problems, but I don't think about covering up. I think we need to manage them for a time frame, but I don't think we can ever find permanent solutions to these problems. I think we are managing them for a time period, and you might think about we're on a sort of pathway, we're on a journey, and what's the best journey that we should we should take would be kind of the question I would pose, and that's maybe a question that coastal societies should be thinking about.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You know, Robert, wealthy cities like New York or London can build floodgates and tide gates to stop the highest surges. But although I noticed New York has not done so, even though Hurricane Sandy flooded lower Manhattan. Have you collected a sort of list of cities who are adapting well and those who are less so?
Well, I mean, I think the cities like the hotspots for good adaptation really are, you say, London. Well, it depends what you mean by good adaptation. Well, certainly in Europe, London, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Hamburg, I mean, cities around the southern North Sea, which have had a long history of flooding, and actually in the 20th century, significant floods and deaths, not necessarily in the Netherlands, actually, but in Amsterdam and Rotterdam, but nearby, they are really taking this issue very seriously and planning for it. That experience is spreading more widely now, so I think there's a much greater awareness of it. A city like Singapore, I think, now is also preparing for these issues, and I think many of the cities in China and Japan are also thinking about it. But clearly, many cities around the world at the present time are still thinking fairly short term. I think to think about sea level rise, you're often thinking 50 years, 100 years into the future in your planning to really be ready for these changes.
You mentioned China, and, you know, they've actually expanded land into the sea. They've filled in an amazing amount. You can see it from satellite. And so I wonder how they're going to fare as the shoreline inevitably moves inland into China.
There's a huge... Asia is an area where there's been a huge amount of land claim over the last 30 years. To be honest with you, every coastal city in the world, including in the United States and Canada, has advanced into the sea, even if it's just the dock areas. Around New York, for example, I've seen maps produced by people at Columbia University that show how New York has advanced out and areas that were marshes have been filled in, etc. And that happens pretty much in every single city around the world because land becomes expensive in cities, so you tend to take it. In Asia, they're doing it a lot now. I think by building that land, obviously that new land is vulnerable to sea level rise. And so I think that the lesson that's learned is that you need to be anticipating sea level rise if you're going to continue doing that. And so, for example, I know in Singapore, so not China, in Singapore, if they claimed new land in future, they would actually do it to a higher level than they did in the past. So they're factoring in sea level rise into their plans already, and I think they would build that land about a meter higher. So, again, it's not a permanent solution, but they're buying a good bit of time to make when that land wouldn't really be flooded. Sea level rise doesn't make this policy... It doesn't mean you stop doing this. It should change how you do it, if you do it.
All right. For our American listeners, where are some of the hot spots for coastal change in the United States?
Well, I mean, I think the Louisiana is really the place where the Mississippi Delta, really, I suppose, you know, but it's also the state of Louisiana. You have basically in New Orleans, sea levels are rising at about 6 millimeters. The city is sinking at 6 millimeters. Per year, and in fact, the whole Delta Plain is sinking at that kind of amount. So that's sort of double what the sea is rising, the rate at which the sea is rising. So it's about 9 millimeters, or almost between friends, a centimeter per year of rise. And there's a huge area of land being lost. People say a football pitch is lost every 15 minutes in Louisiana. I'm not sure that's true anymore, but certainly that's a figure I remember in the past. I'm not up to date with the current rates of loss. But there's very large changes going on there. Another region, I think, which is also a hot spot, but less so, is the Mid-Atlantic. We talked earlier how the land is sinking in some parts of the eastern United States, and particularly between sort of New York and Virginia, it's happening at quite rapid rates. And so you find, for example, around the Chesapeake Bay, that there are quite significant erosion and loss of land going on. So I'd say those are probably the two hotspots. And then Louisiana goes on into Texas. Places like Galveston are also seeing issues around exacerbated sea level rise because the land is sinking.
Well, should we worry that this problem will affect food production in an ever more crowded world?
I think we should be concerned about it. I have been doing work in Bangladesh, and we've been looking at the future of actually agriculture in coastal Bangladesh. If you look at some of the early papers and sea level rise, they show a huge area of Bangladesh going under with a 1 meter rise in sea level. When you work in the real landscape and take into account what's there today, actually there are very large numbers of defences. There's 5,000 kilometres of embankments in Bangladesh, and more than 100 polders exist. You know, as you have in the Netherlands, you have dikes and then you have land behind where the agriculture happens. And when we look at that in our analysis, we find if we did things badly, agriculture could really decline. Equally, if we have scenarios that include likely improvements in plant breeding, things like that, maybe agricultural production could rise. So I don't think it's just about sea level rise. It's also comes back to this issue of adaptation. So I think, in fact, the coastal future is complicated, really. I mean, it's going to depend on multiple things and how they interact. What's the outcome?
Well, maybe it's a King Canute situation. We cannot order the sea to be stable. Do you see yourself now more and more as an advocate for preparation and adaptation?
Well, really, I mean, I think I've come to this issue from the perspective of adaptation, really. My interest was always to understand what are the impacts of sea level rise and what, as a society, can we do about it. And so I think definitely, I think that we should be around the world planning for climate-induced sea level rise. Also, these problems of subsidence that we've discussed today. I mean, again, they're not so, the importance of those varies from place to place, but where this matters, we should be thinking about that. And if you look at London, for example, they have come up with something called the Thames Estuary 2100 project. And that thinks through, how could London deal with a sea level rise up to 5 meters? Doesn't ask when that will happen. It just says, let's imagine sea level rises. What options are available to us? Now, they didn't really evaluate moving London very much in the analysis, but that's obviously an option on the table, implicit in what you're doing. And they looked at the options to keep London where it is, and this costs £15 million, so quite a lot of money. So what's that, $20 million US or whatever? But it means that policymakers can really understand the choices they face with adaptation. And the decision really is in London. They can protect against 1, 2, 3 meters of sea level rise. The options are there. They seem to be affordable. And that's the basis of planning. Now, in other places, maybe you would think you would want to retreat. But even if you want to retreat, you ought to be thinking about that today and not waiting for the storm that pushes you back. So I would be encouraging proactive planning to really be coming up with approaches that we feel can be sustained over the coming decades and longer so that we can have prosperous, healthy, vibrant societies in our coastal areas.
And from your experience, does it take disaster to get governments going to protect their coasts?
Well, I think you do hit on a good point. I mean, certainly a hurricane or superstorm Sandy or a hurricane Katrina in Louisiana, these events shape how we manage our coasts. And certainly they bring home the fact that there's a problem. That's unfortunate, and I suppose one of my kind of passions really is to try and get people to be more proactive and in a set react really to virtual disasters that we might simulate in a computer rather than real ones. But unfortunately, human beings do seem to react, and the political process does seem to react, still seems to sometimes need real events to actually trigger actions.
All right, we're about to wrap up, but I have to ask you, with your experience, do you think that we are in kind of a lag time for climate action because of the pandemic, because of the economic threats that we face? Have we Have we set it on the back burner? Because that really would worry me, because nothing in these natural processes from the ice melt and the heating has stopped. It's all still going, but we're not.
I think clearly the last year has been, other issues have been more to the fore. I've worked at home for the last 12 months, which is something I never really expected in a million years. If you told me a little bit before, that's what would have happened. But I think, people are preparing. The COP26 will be happening in Glasgow in the autumn in the UK. And we're making lots of preparations for that. I think it's, as I have said already, I think it's very important that we mitigate climate change to try and reduce sea level down to manageable levels. So I think there's still a lot of urgency there, and I think many people are still pushing on that. And I think it's important to keep on reminding people of these challenges. And I think in the coastal zone, it's dealing with sea level rise and climate change, and also the other problems. So the substance issue we've mentioned as well, we also want to be dealing with that, so that we, as I say, give a coastal zone for the future that people want to live in and can have prosperous and healthy lives.
Our guest has been Professor Robert J. Nichols. You can find links to his new paper in Nature Climate Change and other information and materials, a couple of his YouTube videos, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
If you live or work in a city, we have news about your future. New research shows climate projections of 2 or 3 degrees C warming are not for you. The trouble is, numbers you hear about warming are the global average, so that includes the oceans covering about 70% of the planet's surface. More than half of all humans live in cities now, and the United Nations projects that will go to over two-thirds by 2050. Because cities only cover about 3% of Earth's surface, they do not show up in global climate models. Now a team led by Dr. Li Zhao zeroes in on what cities can really expect. He is the lead author of the new paper, Global Multi-Model Projections of Local Urban Climates. That was published January 4, 2021 in Nature Climate Change. Li Zhao says, during this century, the average city temperature will rise 4 degrees C, 7 degrees Fahrenheit, higher than the year 1900 temperatures. Depending on geography, some cities will heat less than that, some will heat much more, and all will get even hotter during heat waves. Many cities will heat beyond human endurance. It will be dangerous to be outside for long. City dwellers will depend on air conditioning and the energy required to run all that. That is already true in many cities around the world, but the heat is just getting started. I have a 26-minute interview with Dr. Li Zhao, currently at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Illinois. After graduating from Nanjing University, Li got his doctorate at Yale. He specializes in the physics and engineering of the atmosphere, with a focus on urban environments. We don't have time here for the whole conversation this week, and some of you would find Dr. Zhao's English second language a bit difficult. That is a growing problem now that so much great climate research is coming from Chinese-educated scientists. We can't ignore the kind of genius Dr. Zhao brings, and yet English listeners are not used to working our ears so hard. We expect the voices of professional broadcasters to tell us everything. To get this important information out, I am posting the full interview with Li Zhao in Radio EcoShock's blog posted March 17, 2021, at ecoshock.org. That is free audio that you can either download or just click an arrow to listen right then. You do not need to sign up or give your email or anything like that. There is no advertising. I will summarize our conversation now and play a couple of clips, but it is always best to listen to the source for yourself. Dr. Zhao's team used innovative techniques to capture urban warming from a series of different climate models. Cross-checking with a multi-model approach increases confidence in the results. We know cities get much hotter than their surrounding countrysides. Vegetation can cool the land, up to a point, by providing shade and transpiring water. That's a process that works like an evaporative cooler. By contrast, the materials used in cities absorb heat, like black asphalt roads and roofs. Vertical structures in cities block air transport that might have taken heat away. Then we add all kinds of heat in air conditioner and vehicle exhaust. Cities are heat engines. You have heard about the urban heat island effect, and I have covered that on Radio EcoShock with guests like Dr. Matt Santamouris, Eunice Lowe, and Jane Baldwin. In 2018, I interviewed Dr. Santamouris in Australia about city heat. He measured temperatures of 158 degrees Fahrenheit, 70 degrees C, on an upper-level car park in Darwin. Some places in cities can burn your skin, they're so hot. Here's Dr. Lei Zhao about why cities will get much hotter.
When we build cities, we cut down trees, we convert the bare soil or vegetated surface into man-made built structures. So those kind of conversion from pervious surface into impervious surfaces will reduce evaporative cooling. So city will become hotter. And the second reason is, you know, in cities, you can see we have large fraction of vertical faces, like built structures, and those could reduce the turbulent transport of the sensible heat that removed from the surface. So that's like trapping the heat into the urban layer, into the urban canopy layer. So that cause could lead to another warming effect. And also in the cities, because the materials of the, you know, built structures are different from natural surfaces, right, from the vegetated surfaces. This kind of artificial materials of the buildings, other surfaces in the city, those are a good heat capacitor. So they absorb the heat during the daytime, and then they can release at nighttime. So that's really what we call a release of a stored heat.
So most humans will get much hotter than the 1.5 or 2 or 3 degrees C warming discussed by world scientists and governments. I can't stress this enough. Most humans, most of you, will experience heat well beyond that. At times, Dr. Zhao tells us, cities will reach heat as much as 7 degrees C, that is 12 degrees Fahrenheit, hotter than the surrounding countryside, which is already sizzling. Large-scale climate models simply can't pick that up.
If it's under a high emission scenario or a business as usual scenario, then the city can be warmed up to 7 degrees Celsius in certain like hotspot regions. And so we are talking about like 1 to 7 degree warming in future, and with a lot of areas actually has warming larger than 4 degree.
Dr. Zhao confirms there is special concern for extra heat in cities during the night. Health studies show far more people die in heat waves when their bodies do not get a chance to cool down at night. Cities in this 21st century will be much hotter at night than previously. That also means more energy use at night, and with our current electric system, even more global warming gases from fossil-based power stations. No, those coal, oil, and gas power plants are not shutting down in the next few years. The hotter it gets, the more energy we use, the more greenhouse gases. Productivity also drops. The Zhao study in Nature Climate Change finds one possible mitigating factor. Humidity goes down in cities during the heat. That is key because the combination of heat and humidity causes human death. The guideline is 35 degrees C wet bulb temperature, a scale that measures when our bodies can no longer cool themselves using sweat. But in our interview, Lei Zhao says the ever-increasing heat in cities will overwhelm the lesser humidity, returning to the danger zone. The amount of new heat will vary from city to city depending on many factors, including geography. For example, their projections show cities in the east and northern parts of China will get significant warming. Multiple models show city in the east and north China will undergo about 4 degrees C of warming average this century. Zhao cites the study Future Temperature in Southwest Asia projected to exceed a threshold for Human Adaptability, as published in Nature Climate Change in October 2015. Looking at South America, the urban hot zones to watch will be inland cities, but it is everywhere. The authors say, quote, cities in the United States, Middle East, Northern Central Asia, Northeastern China, and inland South America and Africa are estimated to experience substantial warming of more than 4 degrees C, larger than regional warming, by the end of this century, end quote. Giles says studies of coming heat waves in cities are very alarming, going beyond the safety range, beyond human adaptability. So you're still dealing in averages, though. I mean, would the 4.4 degree C worst-case scenario for urban heat reflect the heat that actually shows up? Could some cities become even hotter during heat waves?
Yeah, exactly. So what we are showing here, we actually are showing a summer monthly mean or decadal monthly mean average. So it's indeed an average case. So it is not the extreme event. So so you can consider this is more showing a norm rather than extreme. So then people can expect that during the heat waves, the cities can be even hotter, can be a lot hotter. Actually, there are indeed studies previously, they show that kind of under this kind of worst case scenario, what's the warming in cities during heat waves. And the results are really devastating, it's really alarming. If you look at those warming, those temperature numbers, it's actually far beyond the kind of the safety threshold or far beyond the human adaptivity limit. People use like web up temperature to indicate as, you know, human adaptivity threshold. I think 35 degree in web up temperature, that's kind of a commonly used threshold for human adaptivity. And, you know, those kind of during heat waves, those warming scenarios can be much larger than this threshold.
As Dr. Santamouras told us, there is a lot we can do to alleviate some of the heat in cities. Greening up cities is crucial, with trees and plants of all kinds everywhere. Every other surface should be white to reflect more of the sun's energy back into space. We need to increase urban albedo levels. Of course, more city infrastructure will go underground where it's cooler, and homes with basements will increase with value, I would think. There are things we can do. Electric cars do not have hot exhaust systems, while solar and wind power do not add more greenhouse gases when energy demand goes up in heat waves. As with most diseases, though, the best cure is not to get it in the first place. Humanity needs to scramble into an all-out emergency change to prevent the worst climate outcomes. Either that or get ready to suffer through this century. Maybe we can all move back into caves. Be sure to listen to the Straight Science About City Heat from Dr. Lei Zhao with the full interview at ecoshock.org, posted March 17, 2021. If this show has stressed you out a little, go back to last week's broadcast, Coping with the Climate Crisis, with UK climate psychologist Ro Randall. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our common future.
Bye.